Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Glendale Christian Church. We're glad to have you here with us today. We are continuing our sermon series through the book of Ecclesiastes. We just started this last week, and so kind of introduce it a little bit. We're going to look at the first little bit here today, but to introduce it, I wanted to share a dialogue between two people that I came across this week, two people that were discussing the top five problems of the day. And so here they were, the top five problems of the day. You know, I feel like it's a Letterman list. You know, who's got the drum roll, you know, going on. But here are the top five problems. Number one, the threat of war. You probably understand that. Number two, the assault on traditional marriage and the consequences that has for the stability of society. The problem of many of the youth. Pathetic attitude toward life and rejection of their parents' values and hard work and sacrifice. You know, we think the millennial generation, right? Corrupt politicians and injustice within the courts, right? And then this last one, maybe we push it down a little bit, but this was a big one, the terrible condition of potholes in the public roads. Now, the interesting thing, you know, is that when we look at this, we're probably going, yeah, I could probably see each of those. But the very, very interesting thing about this list is that it was written 2,500 years ago by two Greek philosophers, historians, actually, Herodotus and Thucydides. They had a dialogue back and forth where they were talking about the most pressing problems that they experienced in ancient Greece. And the sad thing is that today, 2,500 years later, most of the items on that list, including the last one, are still present in our society, aren't they? Kind of makes us wonder, why are we dealing with the same problems again and again? Why is it with all of the technological advances that we've made in the last 2,500 years, with the vastly increased knowledge that we have about the world around us, why is it that these same things our problem today as they were 2,500 years ago? It's one of the reasons that as a pastor, that I became a pastor, because I think that when the Bible speaks, it speaks to us where we are. It speaks to things that are relevant in our lives. And even though we look at a book that was written at least probably maybe 2,200 years ago, 2,300 years ago, at the absolute, you know, earliest, it speaks to us today. It speaks to the situations that we're going through. And it deals with many of the same questions that we're asking. What is the significance and meaning and purpose in life? What does that mean for us as individuals? What does that mean for us as a society? Those are the kinds of questions that the writer of Ecclesiastes set himself to answer. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, whether it was Solomon himself or whether it was somebody, a wise person writing, using the wisdom of Solomon and his familiarity with Solomon, set himself to answer these questions. It's kind of like one of the wisest guys, you know, not a wise guy, but a wise man, you know, that at the end of his life is kind of, you know, let me take stock, let me share the insights that I have. And they're insights that are not just, you know, the observations of a human being. You know, it's not just like the writings of Confucius or some other ancient writer. But this is something that God inspired to be able to share something about ourselves. Help us understand something there a little bit more. And so what we want to do is we want to look at Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We're going to look at verses 1 through 11. So if you've got your Bible, feel free to pull those open and start turning there. If you don't have a Bible, look around in one of the seats in front of you. There's Bibles that are underneath there, and you can either grab one right there or have someone pass you one down the road. You can feel free to use that. And if you don't have a Bible and would like one, feel free to take one. But we want to look at this, and we want to look specifically at sort of the thesis statement of the book of Ecclesiastes. The writer's going to come in and he's going to tell us, here's what Ecclesiastes is all about in the first 11 verses. And then throughout the rest of the 12 chapters, he's going to develop these. Okay? But what we want to do is to look at what he has to say about finding meaning in life. So let's have a look at these first 11 verses. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does a man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and it goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. And on its surface, the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun, even the apostles. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. Many people have read those words and said, man, this is kind of a downer book. Why are we talking about that on Sunday morning? And let me share with you a couple of things. One of the things I think that we need to understand that I introduced last week, and I'll remind you throughout the series, is that when we talk about the preacher, and we look at his inquiry, the preacher has restricted the scope of his inquiry to what is, as he terms it, under the sun. And what we mean by under the sun is a focus on this life with its resources only. If we were just pictured that life is just what we see around us, what we can touch and hear and taste, and just this physical stuff around us. If we limit our investigation of life into this, this is what the preacher wants to do. And in essence, what he's doing is that if we consider just this world and we ignore the spiritual dimension of life, what he's trying to do in a backwards kind of way is to say, okay, take this world, ignore the spiritual dimension to life, how does that work out? Where does that lead us if we don't have a spiritual dimension to life? So one of the things that you need to get, this isn't a downer book. The preacher's goal is not to destroy our hope in this life. What he's rather helping us understand is how this life can be properly enjoyed. What do we legitimately do with this life? How can we find it to be a blessing for the time that we're here? And that's how we can enjoy this life. That's how we can make an impact. But first, what he has to do is show us where meaning cannot be found. And so he goes through and gives us several different examples here. But these first three verses are focused on that. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? That's the question. So the answer comes in, the preacher's first conclusion, that human activity that is under the sun is just as empty as the natural world's endless activity. Ultimately, they're both pointless. And he gives us several different examples that we can look at here. Let's have a look starting in verse 3. What does man, he says, gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, and around goes the wind, and on its surface the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. The place where the streams flow, there they flow again. See, all of these things are characterized by one thing. They are vanity. It's a translation of the Hebrew word hevel, which literally means a vapor or a breath. All of these things are just like a breath that comes along, and the one characteristic that's important about a breath is that it makes no permanent impact. Try it. Everybody, breathe in. Now breathe out. What changed? Absolutely nothing. The breath goes out and you can't even see it. You can't touch it. It's gone. It's been transformed. There's no impression that it's made on the world around us. Its effects do not last. And because its effects do not last, there's a pointlessness to it. So just consider the natural world and look and see some of the pointlessness. Look at the sun. The sun moves across the sky. Then it reaches its destination. You know, sun rises and sun sets, so this is sort of just an anthropological, look at the universe. You know, we're just going to describe what we see. And what we know is that, once it sets, then it's hastening back around to come and to do it again. It just keeps on doing it and doing it and doing it repetitively. Does anything change in that? It just keeps on going. Sun rises today, it's going to rise tomorrow. What about the wind? Well, the wind gives the appearance of great commotion. I mean, it's blowing this way and it's blowing that way. But what difference does it make? You know, there's always going to be more wind. It doesn't, you know, it moves unpredictably. And so then even when it does move, it doesn't make any lasting change. You know, think of, anybody ever been, you know, out in like the sand dunes? And you watch the wind come through and it blows the dunes all over the place. And so there's one dune that was here. Now the wind blows in a crazy way and it blows it over here. And you're like, ah, yay, it made some change. And the next day, you know, the wind comes the other way and it blows it right back. And it just blows the sand blowing in the wind. No lasting change. Nothing of significance. He talks about the streams in verse 7, that they constantly flow into the sea. Streams, the water is constantly running, it's pouring. Does the sea get any higher? No. We know the water cycle means that, you know, what gets poured in, you know, eventually gets evaporated and then it comes back around. But it's an endless cycle that keeps on going and going and going. And it doesn't change the sea level at all. So what the writer's doing is he's prompting us to say, look, if you look at nature, and you see a lot of activity that changes nothing. You know what? That's a picture of what human life is like. How many of us feel like we're gerbils on the wheel? Running around and making no lasting impact whatsoever. You know, just burning up, you know, our fuel and energy, sleeping every now and then and doing that. That's the picture that he's giving us here. Human activity is frantic. But what change does it make? He says in verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. It's one of the incredible ironies of Scripture that when we think about the biblical perspective on humanity, humanity was made to be the rulers of this world. We were given charge of it. And yet the world outlasts us. We die and are buried. Another generation comes and they have nothing to do with us. Human generations come and go, dealing with the same problems, generation after generation, including the potholes, right? The planet endures. So human life, he says, and here's the key, human life under the sun. Remember that what the author is doing is he's saying, let's examine human life just from this perspective of under the sun, just taking into account this life. He says, if all you do is to take into account this life, human life on those terms is just like these natural processes, short-lived and fleeting, repetitive and monotonous, aimless and purposeless, changing nothing. That's the perspective that we get if we look at life solely from this under-the-sun perspective. And so that, you know, we recognize this. I mean, how many of us will talk about the daily grind that we go to, you know? Not the coffee shop, you know, I understand there's one of those out there, but you know, the daily grind is just us going through our repetitive motion. You know, fortunately for most of us, it brings a paycheck at the end of the week, and so that is a little bit of something, but it's just, you know, that in turn goes into all the things that we need, you know, houses and cars and insurance and food and, you know, all the stuff that we need to do. This is where we can say it's the same stuff, just a different day. The rat race. You know, and I almost put up here the picture of Sean Bean, you know, with the brace yourselves, Monday's coming, you know, but I didn't want to, you know, do too much of a reminder because, you know, tomorrow is Monday. And it's kind of, you know, we want this to be a positive message, you know, to be thinking about, not, you know, oh my goodness, tomorrow's Monday. This is what we're talking about. Human activity considered in these terms is really aimless. The second conclusion that he looks at is, well, let's actually look at some of the human activity. His second conclusion is that human experience under the sun is dull and ultimately unsatisfying. Look what he has to say starting in verse 8. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which is said, see, this is new? It's been already in the ages before us. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after. You know, think about this, the eyes and the ears. You know, the idea that the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. We're talking about satisfaction. We're talking about ultimately getting, you know, like, ah, That's it. I don't need any more. It was true for most of us when the eye sees something and we go, wow, that's beautiful. No matter how beautiful it is to the eye or how pleasing it is to the ear, at the end of the day, we're not thinking like, okay, that's it. I never need to see anything else again. We're thinking, give me more, give me more. It's a continual striving because although we may be satiated at some point, it's like we've had our meal and we're full. We're going to be hungry again. We're never going to be fully satisfied with what we see in this life. The second example that he gives, verses 9 through 11, talks about human history. History, it looks like, is going nowhere. You know, now, granted, there's different names of, you know, whoever the supreme ruler is and, you know, leaders of countries and all that kind of stuff. There are some minor changes. But ultimately, history is going nowhere because although it appears to change and there's some superficial changes, fundamentally at the base level, there's nothing new under the sun. It fundamentally stays the same. There's a couple reasons for that. Genuinely new things rarely happen in the human race. And even when they do, still at the heart of it and still guiding it are the same sinful and fallen human beings. You know, technology changes. And so we think about, you know, like somebody invented, hey, you know, I can make a spear, and that means I can kill a bigger animal than what I was able to before with just my bare hands. And I can make a bow and an arrow, and that's great. And pretty soon somebody realizes, hey, it's a lot easier to go kill this person who doesn't have any arms and take his stuff, and then I have my food, and I can, you know, plunder him and do all that stuff, and you've got war. So now think about it today. You know, all we have are, you know, guns and drones and tanks and planes and all that kind of stuff, but it's the same basic idea. The technology has changed, but the human activity and the human desire to take something that belongs to someone else hasn't changed one bit. Why is it, despite all of our advanced technology, we still deal with the same things that Herodotus and Thucydides dealt with? Because human nature doesn't change. Human nature has stayed the same. So what about when something new does come along? Well, pretty soon it becomes old and forgotten, doesn't it? I can remember it was 3 years ago that we finally, our cell phones, you know, were starting to die. And I remember that, you know, the new iPhone 5 came out, right? Ooh, it was shiny. Apple had a big event, and look at all the new things that it's going to do. And, you know, we needed new phones, and there was a good deal, and we got that kind of stuff. And, you know, a week ago, Apple came out with the new iPhone 7. You know, so every year they come out with a new one. And I don't know about you, but has the luster kind of worn off a little bit? You know, we look and we say, I mean, I know, I was really excited, wow, I got a new phone, and it does all these cool things, and now it's like the battery doesn't last as long, and I have to restart it, you know, so many times, you know, to get it to work and do what it's going to do. The new stuff gets boring and old. And probably all of us can remember some purchase that we got, something, man, I really, really want that, maybe we saved for it and all that kind of stuff, and we got it, and yes! And now it's looking at its dust, because we've acquired it, and it's lost that newness, that luster, that was, you know, probably more to the fact that we didn't have it and wanted it. We lose when we possess it. Children are like that with toys. So are adults with our toys, right? We see in verse 11 that knowledge and recognition, that, you know, when we look in the past, we have some names that pop out, but how many are forgotten by history? Their accomplishments are lost over time. And if that's the case, if even our accomplishments are lost over the time, the preacher asks, what value is that? If all the hard work that you're doing right now doesn't do anything, why engage in the rat race? Why be the hamster on the wheel? In Life Under the Sun, he's saying, people confirm the saying penned a little while ago, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Not only do most people know the saying, most of us don't even remember who said it. You have to Google it and look it up. George Santayana, by the way, so if you wanted to know who that is, that's who it is. But that was 100 years ago. Well, 110 years ago, actually, when he wrote that. Most of us have heard the saying, but don't even remember the person. The interesting thing that I found is that if we think about this approach to life, and we think about just what we have here and how to deal with it, even secular philosophy has had to grapple with this. I mean, any of you remember in school when, you know, you're looking at kind of a survey of some philosophical ideas and we have nihilism, you know, or nihilism from the Latin word nihil, meaning nothing. And it's this idea that life, you know, the recognition that life is without objective meaning or purpose. And so what happens is that when I realize that, and that hits me like a ton of bricks, oftentimes what that does is cause despair at the pointlessness of creation. And many people just kind of walk through that despair and just try to do the best that they can. One of the counters to that, or at least an answer to that, is the view of existentialism. Anybody remember that from school? You know, the idea that what we do is that we recognize that life is meaningless, so instead we choose something that is going to have meaning in our lives and we live for that. We basically create the meaning. You know, like, it's going nowhere. I know the truth that this author is talking about, but I'm going to, you know, for my kids, I'm going to choose to live for my kids. I'm going to give them the best opportunity possible, and that's what I live for. And I've suddenly made them the focus of my life. Or maybe for some of us, we make success what we're trying to do. I want to reach a certain level, and whether that's a financial mark, or I want to have a certain number of people that I'm in charge of, or I want to attain to some political office or something like that. We set some goal for ourselves, and that becomes the sole thing that consumes us. That's the best that this world has to offer, is that we create our own meaning. If we consider life under the sun, these are the best two options that we've got. So the challenge for us as Christians is to figure out, well, what do we do with this? The preacher's given us a thesis. And what he's going to do is he's going to say, okay, you don't think this is true? Guess what? Let me walk you through everything in life that I see people trying to put and trying to make ultimately their fundamental thing. And you know what? At the end of it, he's going to look at each of them and say, you know what? That's empty. That's empty. That's empty too. It's all part of his procedure to be able to tell us where life's meaning cannot be found. And that's an important thing. So one of the things that we first have to do is we have to accept where he's going with this. And if you're still skeptical, if you're on the fence, you're like, I don't know, I'm not sure, I want to see. Let's look at this guy. You know, not now. I mean, I've only got the first 11 verses. We've got several more chapters to go through. But come with me and let's walk through and let's see. Let's test it and see if there is genuine meaning there. Because what I think he's going to challenge us to do is to accept that we can't find meaning under the sun. That's just not going to be possible. That in terms of this life, we're going to run up with something that is vanity, vanity, all vanity. And that's a thesis. So then the question is, well, what can make life purposeful and satisfying? How can we break free from this picture of the monotonous existence that he's painting for us, based on observation of what people have tried to do? And so here's what I want you to think of. If meaning cannot be found in life that is limited to the physical world, that's under the sun, then we have to find meaning beyond this world. That's what he's challenging us to think about. If it can't be found here, you know, it's not like we're going to go to Mars and suddenly find it there. Because Mars is still part of this world system, okay? If we're going to find meaning, we're going to have to get it from outside of this. It's not going to be found in the physical universe. It's going to involve a spiritual universe. And that's what he's challenging us to do. So one of the things that I think that this book, it's almost like an apologetics book. This is a way of challenging, you know, two different kinds of people. The first kind of person is a person that when we look, especially in a New Testament perspective, that has not put their trust in Jesus Christ, that hasn't yet established a relationship with God, that doesn't have that spiritual dimension to their lives. You know, now, in his day and age, Jesus hadn't been born, hadn't died on the cross yet, so he was looking forward to that. He maybe didn't have all the particulars of the plan. Since we do, we can look back and say, if we want to have a spiritual connection with God, it's through Jesus Christ. If you've not put your trust in Jesus Christ, you need to take that first step. Because if you don't do that, everything that you pursue in life, as we're going to see and as he's going to show us, is a chasing after the wind. Now, I'll tell you that this is one of the hard things, not usually in church to say, but usually outside of the church, because people will say, wait a second, that's really exclusive. And how can you do that? Well, truth is exclusive. You know, if it's true that I'm wearing a green shirt,
then it means that I exclude the possibility that I'm wearing a red one, or a blue one, or a pink one, or chartreuse, or whatever. You know, pick your color. I mean, it only can be green, if that's true. Okay? Truth limits and truth excludes. And Jesus himself said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Not one way among many. You know, one of the truths out there, or there's lots of lies, I just happen to be one of them. He says, I'm the way, the truth, the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me. Now, if Jesus was wrong about that, he's a fallible human being. Why would we want to put our trust in him? He wouldn't be worthy of our worship if he was wrong. But if he's right about this, there's no other way to God except through him. And I'll tell you that if we read the New Testament, as we see what it has to say about Jesus, as we see his character, it becomes really clear that the idea that Jesus is a liar, that he was fallible and wrong, doesn't fit into the equation. If Jesus is right about this, there is no other way to God except through him. And so we have a conscious choice to make. Are we going to put our trust in Jesus, or are we going to choose to reject him and find ourselves in this place of chasing after the wind, living life only with the physical resources here? The one thing that I love about God is that he never forces any of us to make this choice. If we don't want to spend eternity with him, he will never force someone to spend eternity with him against their will. We've got to choose it. The second kind of person that this speaks to is the person who does believe in Christ. And the challenge that we have is that believers in Christ need to examine themselves to see whether we are living for Christ or for the things of this world. To be granted that we live in the world around us, there's sort of two ways to approach this living life. I have a relationship with Jesus, but am I pursuing this life in the same way that somebody who's standing over here that's not a Christian at all is pursuing life? Am I going after it in the same way? Am I pursuing the same kinds of things that they're pursuing? Because if that's what I'm doing, I may be a Christian, but I'm just as much chasing after the wind as they are. And so the challenge that we have, you know, as I mentioned, that the preacher, somehow or another, this teaching goes back to the person of Solomon. Solomon is a great example for us. Here's a man who knew God, who is greatly blessed by God, who is given a wisdom beyond what any human being had ever been given, but was also, because he asked for that wisdom instead of other things, given wealth and power. What we read in the book of Kings and the book of Chronicles is that that man, with all the blessings that he had, turned away from God. That man walked on his own. That man began pursuing the things of this world, chasing after the wind. Many people have thought that the reason that the author of Ecclesiastes wrote this way is because it's referring back to that. Solomon learned his lesson. Man, I thought I could find it in these things apart from God. And boy, was I wrong. It's a much more powerful message if we think that there's at least some understanding and maybe even an editor or somebody coming back and portraying and sharing Solomon's story so that we can learn from it. If he couldn't figure life out under the sun, you know, solely in terms of this life, if he couldn't do it, none of us have a chance. None of us have anything near the resources at our disposal. But the challenge that I see is that many Christians today are pursuing these exact same goals as everyone else. We're looking for happiness and fulfillment to make our mark and achieve our own personal family goals in this life. And if we do that, I think that we're going to, you know, the picture of the person who's climbing the ladder to success, get to the very top and realize, wow, this ladder is leaning against the wrong wall. None of us want to be in that boat. And if we are on that wrong ladder, man, the sooner we figure out that we're on that wrong ladder, we can climb down and start climbing up the right one. That's what this wisdom is trying to challenge us with. If life on earth is intended to have God at its center, we cannot have God at its center and pursue the things of this life as if they're ends in and of themselves. That's all that there is to it. It's foolish for us to think that we can walk on this world's path for the whole of our lives, and then when we stand before God, present our salvation as like an insurance policy. Okay, I'm cashing in on it. You know, here's my eternal life insurance.
And God be like, awesome, you did great. It's not going to happen. That's not the way that it works. God's calling us to give everything here today. And the paradox is that if we give God everything here today, we're going to find that instead of being meaningless, the things of this life can genuinely be enjoyed the way God intended them, as a gift from Him to us. That's where we're going, and that's what we're going to see. So I know this is starting off, you know, don't let it get you down a little bit. Remember where this is coming from. If we consider just this life, there's not a lot of hope. What we're going to do is we're going to see how we can incorporate a spiritual dimension to life, and that will make a difference. That will give us something that we can sink our teeth into. So I'm going to ask Howard and the gang, you guys have a closing song? All right, come on up. Let me just remind you that we do have, during our second hour today, some Sunday school classes. Come and join us in those. This is an opportunity where, especially if you're new to the church and you'd like to get to know some of us, come to one of our classes and just, you know, sit with us. They're like small groups. You know, we talk about the Bible. We laugh. We do all kinds of stuff. And that's an important thing, you know, so that we can get to know one another, so that we can help one another walk through the challenges of this life. There's value in that. And don't forget, too, that the membership class, I was originally going to say that we were in Steve's room, but since Steve's here, you know, last week he wasn't here, I was like, oh, better not tell them to go to his room because the membership class won't be there. So downstairs, for those of you that were in the class last week, it'll probably be just the next room over. And if you're not sure where that is, where's John? See John right there. He will be happy to take you to that. We'd love for you, if you'd like to learn some more about the church, who we are, come and join us for that. We'd love to have you with us. So, Howard.